I think we still have a couple of minutes. We are looking at floating point numbers. Some of the basic information is available to you about on this card, which tells you about all the five cases, including the usual case, which is in which case the exponent is somewhere between 1 to maximum minus 1, and maximum is of course all 1s. And we have seen that there is a certain bias used, which is 127 for a single precision, which you have to subtract. Also, I had mentioned that when the exponent is all zeros, and the fraction is something that is other than zero, in that case, it is a denormalized number, and that hidden one is no longer there. And for single precision numbers, so basically you take the mantissa, and that is multiplied by 2 raised to minus 126. That is the convention. Now the floating point number scheme, it has gone through some evolution, and the scheme that we studied, which is one of the IEEE standards, so that is the scheme that everyone uses now. Are there any questions or comments so far? And we're looking at floating point addition, and we had seen the hardware. So basically, one of the key steps is that you need to align the floating point numbers that you want to add, so that the decimal point, so to say, is in the same position. And basically, you make the exponents equal. And that is the central part of the procedure we have seen. And then, okay, now let's look at floating point multiplication. How would we do a floating point multiplication? Now, do we start by aligning the exponents in floating point multiplication? So basically, we are multiplying two numbers. So we have some number which we have the sign, and then let's assume that they are normalized numbers of 1 point something multiplied by 2 raised to something. But here is one number. And then we multiply it by another number, which is which looks like this. So how do we multiply two floating point numbers? And obviously, we need to when you multiply two numbers, then as you remember from algebra, the powers add, right? So if you have x raised to let's say a multiplied by x raised to b, that is equal to x raised to a plus b. So basically that is what we need to do for the exponent. And the one thing to keep in mind is that exponent here is biased, exponent here is biased. So to find the value, you have to subtract 127 from each of them separately. So when you multiply the exponent, what you want is, if you will simply add the two exponents, what you will do, you would actually be adding 127 twice, because you will be adding the two. So actually you need to be adding it only once. So the steps would be, first would be to add exponents and then subtract the bias once. So for example, let's say you have an exponent which is 5, and of course that would be represented as 5 plus 127. And you have, let us say, an exponent of minus 2, and that is represented as minus 2 plus 127. Now, your result should be, of course, minus 3, right? So your result should be minus, oh, I'm sorry. Result should be plus 3, 5 minus 2. Sometimes I forget the basic mathematics that I studied way back in elementary school. Okay, 5 minus 2 is 3. Okay, I guess you can all agree with that. Okay, index, of course, the exponent. The way it would be represented would be this way. So in order to get this, what you need to do is to subtract 127 once. And now this is the exponent, how it will be represented, and its value would be 3, right? So, add the exponents and subtract the bias once, and then you multiply the matrices. So basically, you multiply these things. And here, actually, we are including that 1 if it is there. So basically multiply the other part and then get the result in normalized form. So basically you adjust the exponent so that the result is in normalized form, and then you appropriately handle overflow or underflow. That means if the resulting number is too small or too big, do whatever is necessary. So for example, let's say it is too small for usual normalized floating point number, then what should you do? Go to denormalized numbers, right? Because denormalized number format allows you to represent smaller numbers. But if the result is too big, perhaps generate a message saying that there was an error, the result was too big. And do the rounding. In all the floating point calculations, there are some extra bits that are there for intermediate results. And at the end, you do need to get rid of them. So you round it. And of course, sometimes rounding can cause your normalization to change. Sometimes you round it, and rounding will cause it, maybe cause one more bit to be generated that will go to the left hand side of the decimal point. In that case, you need to renormalize it. And of course, take care of the sign. So, if the two numbers you are multiplying, if they are different in sign, then the answer is negative. Otherwise, the answer is positive. Now, just like we had seen hardware for addition, similarly, we can come up with suitable hardware for floating point multiplication. We are, however, not going to look at the hardware, but you can kind of imagine how it will look like. And I think the book has given a diagram for it, but we are going to skip that. Any questions on floating point multiplication? Okay, let's now look at rounding. Now, we talked about rounding a couple of times. And as I was mentioning, there are some extra bits. So you have extra bits for intermediate values. Is anyone here working on taxes? Anyone here pays taxes? What is the IRS rule on rounding? Is there a rule?
You round up the nearest dollar, right?
Yeah. To nearest dollar? That seems like a good rule. I didn't actually pay any attention to it, so I have probably done it in different ways, and apparently they don't seem to notice it that much. I guess they are looking for people who are trying to hide a million here or a million there, so they are not really very picky about a few cents. However, the question arises, how should things be rounded in case of when you do floating point operations? Now, there are a few different rounding approaches. So you have some extra bits. And so let us assume. So you have a few extra bits. So in the beginning, they had one extra bit, which was called the guard bit. So there was a guard bit. And people were not happy with that, with just the guard bit. So they said, we need one more. So they made, they put another bit, they call it the round bit. And then they had they added perhaps a few more bits. So basically, there are some extra bits, and they go by some names, but I guess their names are not very important. We will just look at a few simple examples. So let's look at rounding approaches. Now there's one approach which would be a simple approach, would be simple truncation. You simply chop them off. Now, all these rounding approaches are supported by the IEEE standard. And typically, in a processor, you have to select the appropriate mode. So for a given algorithm, you can choose the mode that you like, or the mode that goes with whatever algorithm you are using. So truncation, so let's say if you have a number which is Now, just to keep the example simple, let us say we have a number which is 1.1101, and we want to keep one bit on this side of the decimal point, and we want to keep two bits on the other side. Now this is just a simple illustration. Of course, as you know, real mantis are much bigger. So basically, you want to get rid of these two bits. So one approach would be to do truncation, and you will round this to 1.11. And if you have a number which is minus 1.1101, you would round that to minus 1.11. And that is truncation, which is a simple approach. Now there is another approach, which is a rounding towards now, can we say that truncation will result in a smaller number? Can you say that? Or not? Or we can't say that? But in this case, it would be a smaller number. But here, as you see, this is actually a bigger number on the negative side, right?
Yeah, right.
In the magnitude, it is smaller. But in terms of as a signed number, this is actually a smaller number. So we cannot say that this is this will result in a smaller number, right? Now rounding towards plus infinity. Now this rounding approach will always result in the bigger number. So if you have this mode, then if you take 1.1101 and let's say you want to get rid of these two bits, you would round it towards plus infinity. That means that your result would be a little higher. Now what is a little higher than this 1.11? What is something that is just a little higher? Well, that is obviously 1.00, right? That is just a little higher. And of course, that as you will know, this would need a renormalization, right? Because now this is no longer normalized. Because normalized means decimal point comes after the first one. Okay, and let's try this one. 1.1101. Now we are rounding it towards plus infinity. So we round it, and now this would be the result would be a larger number. And that would be minus 1.11, which is a larger number, which means it is larger in the sense of positive numbers. So by larger we mean result is towards plus infinity, right? Now similarly, we can do this. Rounding towards minus infinity. And in that case, the result would always be just a little small. So, using the same example, 1.1101, that we will round to something that is just a little smaller, in other words, towards minus infinity. And minus 1.1101, that will round to what? So something that is just a little smaller, that will round to, in other words, this will round to something which in magnitude is just a little bigger, right? So that is a minus, and of course this needs renormalization. Okay, do you like any of these approaches so far? Or do you think we can come up with something better?
Okay, let's look at the fourth one. The fourth approach is round to nearest.
Now this is the most accurate approach. So this is like how you have been rounding your tax return to the nearest dollar. So this is the most accurate approach. An idea is that you round it to the nearest number. So obviously, this actually would be the default choice. Unless you chose something else, this was what would happen. Now in some cases, when you round it to nearest, sometimes there's a tie. There are two nearest numbers that are available. So you need some rule to break a tie. And so this scheme is called round to nearest even. So round to nearest, and in case of a tie, go to the even number. So here we have, let us say, so 1.1101. So we round to nearest. Okay, now what is nearer to it? This is it nearest? Is the nearest thing 1.11, or is the nearest thing 10.00, which is nearer? Okay, would you say that this is the nearest 1.11? Well, we can check 1.1101. Now, which is the nearest? 1.11, or is it this? Which is nearest? Okay, how much is this? This is of course 1.75, right? And this we know is 2. Okay, and how much is this? So this is 1.75 plus, how much is this? Okay, 0.5, 0.25, 0.125, right? And so this would be 0.06. What is half of 0.125? 0.06, let's say 2.5, right? So this number here happens to be 1.75, so 1.8125, something like that. Is this correct? I hope that is correct. 1.75 and 0.75, I add this. I think that seems to be correct. So you can see that this is closer. And minus 1.1101, the closest thing there is minus 1.11. Now you can see that here, these two digits are a quarter of this bit, right? So basically these two bits means here you have a quarter more than this. And closest thing would be to take out that quarter and just stick with this one. So we do it for both positive and negative. But here is an interesting situation. What should we do in case of, here's an example. Consider this. Minus 1.0010, and we want to get rid of these two bits. So what should we get? What is closest? So remember, relative to this, this one is half, right? And actually half falls, half is just midway between the two choices. So there are two possible things that are equally distant, and you will choose the one that is, as I said, even, in case of a tie. So the nearest even thing would be, you are going to get, so we could make it 1.01, or we could make it minus 1.00, which are equally distant from this. So we want to choose the one that is even, and we will not choose this. Any questions or comments? So basically, these are the approaches. You have simple truncation, or you have rounding towards plus infinity, rounding towards minus infinity, and this, which is the most accurate, which is rounding to closest, and in case of a tie, it is usually called round to nearest even, which might give you a misleading impression that it is always to the nearest even. That's not so. It's round to nearest, and in case of a tie, that is even. Any questions or comments? So that is the end of our discussion on computer arithmetic, and we will now go to the next topic, which is performance. Now we will have, now we should have an assignment or a quiz. And I'm thinking between an assignment and quiz, so which one would, so what do you prefer, an assignment or a quiz? So so you guys seem to be evenly divided on between assignment and quiz. We could make it an assignment-like quiz. So we can make a quiz where you have to maybe spend some time, and it's always a trade-off. So okay, let me think about that, and in any case, be ready for possibly a quiz, most likely online quiz. Oh, we haven't had any surprise quizzes so far. So I should. So you wouldn't be disappointed if we not have any surprise quizzes?
Not at all.
Anyway, so we should have something next time. I will announce that. So perhaps a quiz. We might make it an online quiz. So, and it will cover instruction set, all the everything that we have done, and you should be able to write small programs or large programs if you have more time.
Is this going to be after the midterm or before the midterm?
Oh, you mean this this quiz?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess this will basically cover things we have done after the midterm, but actually some of the things we had done before the midterm, for example, instruction set. So all of the instruction set is included. I think in the midterm we had a couple of relatively simple questions on the instruction set. So let us include all of the instruction set in this quiz. And all of this we have done, so computer arithmetic. Of course, in any quiz or assignment, it is only a few sample questions. So it will never, these things don't really cover everything, but some sample questions. So let's now look at performance. Now in a computer, what do you want? How many of you have purchased a computer, let us say in the last year or so? Okay, so what were you looking for?
Memory,
that's good.
A decent chip and a decent hard drive.
So what do you mean decent chip?
Preferably one that was dual core or something like that.
So you mean higher performance chip? Okay.
And then for hard drive, I wanted at least 80 gigabytes.
So that's memory storage, right? So what people want in computer, now there are some things that you would, now here we are going to focus on the CPU, and CPU is actually part of the processor, but as you said, when you buy a whole system, it's not just the CPU, but you're looking for other things. You're looking for the right display. So you're looking for at least now, what is that? What is the display? Wide W, let's see. What's that?
WXGA.
Yeah, WXGA, right. So you're looking for at least WXGA, which all of them come with. For example, if this is a laptop, so you're looking for, and so that's the display, and you would look for your secondary storage. So you want sufficient secondary storage, so which is your hard drive, and how much is enough these days?
Is there such a thing?
it depends on what kind of stuff you want to store. So I think you need at least 80 gigabytes or so. That's the minimum.
Yeah.
I remember when I first bought a PC, and that was my first PC that I had in my office. And so I had there was one available on top of the line, 20 megabytes. And they said that whoever was selling it, they said that they don't know how I will manage to fill that up. So
I hope they feel stupid now.
So of course, no amount of storage is big enough. So this is and then you want the performance. So you want it to be sufficiently fast. For many applications, speed is perhaps not that much a consideration, but many of you like to play games. So for those of you who like to play games and do other computation intensive stuff, you want it to be sufficiently fast. And then other things, and you want, of course, preferably low power consumption. Now these are the things you want for your system, but here we are considering a processor. Let's talk about specifically the processor. Let us assume we are in the processor business. So we want high performance. And actually, in our course, we have significant emphasis on performance, and our two authors, they basically, their main contribution in computer architecture basically has been regarding performance. So they were contributors towards the RISC approach, which resulted in higher performance designs. So, and in this chapter, we are going to be focusing on performance. But let us list other desirable things you want in a processor. And power consumption is now a very important thing. So you want your battery to last sufficiently long. If it is a laptop, or if it is an embedded processor, if it is in your cell phone or whatever, even if in a desktop thing, you probably want to minimize power consumption. And then, of course, for most of us, cost is a consideration. I guess some people they are willing to pay any amount of money, but some people, I guess for most people, they don't want to pay too much relative to what they are getting. So I guess people want to get value. So cost is an important consideration. And then, of course, we have reliability. You want things to be reliable, and availability, serviceability, and so on. And let's add here usability. Now, you want to be able to run the programs that you are used to running. And that is why Intel has been successful. So they have always designed most of their processors to be upwardly compatible so you have better and better processors, but the software that was written for older processors will still run on the newer processors. So you have this upward compatibility, or as sometimes we say, backward compatibility. Now let's look at computer performance. And we are here going to focus on processor performance. Now there are a few things we want to look at. We want to look at processor performance evaluation. We want to look at architectural design trade-offs. Or why don't we generalize it and say trade-offs. And performance metrics. How do we measure performance? Do we measure performance in clock frequency? What do you think? Clock frequency, is that a measure of performance? No, why not? It used to be.
Because if you have one thing that takes many, many instructions or has to filter down, it doesn't matter if the clock's really fast. If instead you were to make your processor much smaller, make the links much closer together, and things of that nature, you would speed things up far greater than the clock speed will ever do for you.
Right, so there are other things besides clock frequency. So at one time, clock frequency was big. Even now it is, of course. But now there are other things that come into play.
A Xeon with a 2 gigahertz processor will still beat the hell out of Pentium 4 3.0.
So clock frequency alone will not assure you higher performance. So we have to talk about metrics. So how do we measure performance? And How should we evaluate performance? So if you have a, okay, you want to do something, so buy a PC, and you want to evaluate performance, how would you evaluate performance? So the approach would be, so you want something that will run your programs the fastest. Something that will run the type of programs that you typically use, right? So basically for a typical mix of programs, the machine that runs them fastest, in other words, takes the least amount of time, you would consider that machine to have higher performance. So we are going to talk about performance metrics. And we are going to talk about some laws, regarding performance. What do you mean by laws about performance? So is there a legal limit to how fast a computer can run? So by laws we mean there are some trends that people have identified, or there are some mathematical rules that people have stated about performance. We will take a look at them. Including, there's a famous one called Moore's Law. How many of you have heard about Moore's Law? Many of you heard about Moore's Law, so we'll talk about that. Okay, so let's talk about performance metrics. Now, best measure of performance is how fast programs are run. So we can say that performance, and let us say performance of some machine called X. Maybe we are comparing two machines, machine X and machine Y. So performance of X, we will take that as inverse of the execution time. On machine X for a representative mix of programs. So higher execution time means lower performance. And if you compare two machines, so let us say you have two machines, X and Y, and let us say that performance, let me abbreviate this, performance of machine X divided by performance of machine Y, if you want to compare the two, basically we will run our programs on the two machines, and we will take the ratio of the execution time on machine Y divided by the execution time of the machine X, right? Because we have the inverse relationship between performance and execution time. Now let us say that is equal to some number n. And that, let us say n is 3 perhaps. So we can say that the machine X is n times faster than machine Y. Because its performance is n times or its execution time is 1 divided by n.
So if the two machines ran at the same speed, let's say the machine X is 1 times that speed.
Yeah, that's grammatically, if when it is just 1, the sentence grammatically doesn't look good. Right? So if you say machine X is 1 times faster than machine Y, that doesn't look too good. And you could grammatically say machine X is, let us say N is 2. Machine X is 2 times faster than Y. Now this is how we usually say, even though if you are very careful about use of the language, you might have an objection to that. But this is kind of the informal usage of the term. So many times faster than that. Although we realize that from the point of view of precisely stating, so if you want to state it precisely, you should say performance of machine X is n times that of machine Y. That is precisely, exactly stating it. But this is how we, this is in common everyday English. Even though we recognize that it's a little bit odd, especially when n is equal to 1. Now here we talk about representative mix. And that brings us to benchmarks. Now benchmarks, let's say a common term that is used for some examples that, so benchmarks are basically standard examples used for comparison. Now these in our case, these benchmarks are programs. Now you can have benchmarks in hardware design also. So for example, remember we had talked about some minimization methods, and there are some sophisticated minimization algorithms, for example PLAs. So you have the PLA minimization algorithms, and there are some competing ones. So if you want to see which algorithm gives you the best result, or the approach would be to take some benchmark PLAs and run them through competing algorithms and see which one gives you the best result. And because the benchmarks are standard, you will be doing a fair comparison. Now in case of computer performance, now there are competing processors. Now is that true? Are there still competing processors, or has one particular company won? Now fortunately there has always been competition, even though a certain company has dominated for a long time. So there has been competing architectures. Some people have argued about which is better. And so people decided that valid comparisons would mean to take some benchmarks, and everyone has to agree that those are the benchmarks that they will use. And so they came up with some benchmarks, and they have updated these benchmarks time to time. So for example, there are spec benchmarks. There is actually, this spec is an organization. So they have SPEC CPU 2000 benchmarks. So these are a collection of programs. Now in the beginning they had just a single collection, but then they realized that they actually need two kinds of benchmarks. They need integer benchmarks
and they need some floating point benchmarks. And the reason is that in a lot of applications, you don't use that much floating point, as we were discussing that, I think, was that last time? So in that case, you don't want to look at floating point benchmarks. Perhaps this is what you are interested in. However, if you are doing a lot of floating point, you are doing spreadsheet analysis or scientific calculations, then you may want to look at both. So you have a number of programs here. So now this, I have this list of programs, and I guess I should have counted them, but I see about how many are these? 15 or 17 programs. So there are 15 or 17 programs here, 15 or 17 programs here, and these are called specint 2000, and these programs are called spec floating point 2000. And if you go to spec website, you can download these programs and you can run these programs and evaluate the performance. I think you can download them free. I'm not sure, but I don't know, maybe they charge some fee for downloading, but anyway, they are available, you can get them. And you can run them and see how processors compare. And in case you are interested, here is the URL. URL for them is www.spec.org. You go there, and they also provide detailed information. And their programs include, integer programs. There's a data compression program, there's an FPGA circuit placement and routing program, there's a C compiler, there's a network flow solver, there's a chess program, natural language program, there's a ray tracing, Perl, object-oriented database, and so on. And for the floating point programs, you have quantum chromodynamics, whatever that is, shallow water modeling, these are scientific floating point things, multi-grid solver and 3D potential field, parallel electric partial differential equations. How many of you work with parabolic elliptical partial differential equations? Well, some people do. So if you are doing floating point work, so this is part of the floating point suite of programs, which are part of this here. And you can evaluate, now, the numbers that you get are normalized. So basically, for each program, you will get a number and you will normalize it with respect to a reference machine. Now notice that this, they have a reference machine for spec CPU 2000. The reference machine happens to be a Sun Ultra 510 with a 300 megahertz processor. So this is the reference machine. Now in the past, they used to, at one time, the reference machine was a certain mini computer. It was a DEC mini computer. How many of you have heard about DEC? Which was a machine, which was a company that was famous for their mini computers, and they came out with a number of interesting innovations. And then the mini market, when the mini computers were very nice devices, so when they came out, the regular computers would take a room, and the mini computers would just take one cabinet about this high. And so with advantage of a mini computer would be that you can roll your mini computer into another room if necessary. So they used to use one of the mini computers as a reference machine. And at one time, the price of the used machine, that reference machine, was substantially higher than other similar machines, because people needed it for performance comparisons. Because that was defined to be the reference machine. So they got rid of it as a reference machine. So this is now the reference machine against which other machines would be measured. For example, okay, now here's an example. Let me mention a machine. Now this is a Dell PowerEdge. $17.50. Now this is just one particular machine, which is has a 3.06 gigahertz Xeon processor, and they analyzed this machine using this, and they found, so basically, you run all the benchmarks on the target machine. So for example, on this machine, you will run all the benchmarks. Now if you run the benchmarks on the reference machine, it will take about 2 days for you to run all the benchmarks. It takes much less if you run it on this 3 gigahertz Xeon machine. Now these numbers are from August 2003, and they found that Cint 2000 measure for this machine is 1067, and C floating point 2000, so spec floating point 2000 measure was 1152. So what does this mean? Now this means that this machine is more than 1,000 times faster than the reference machine. And considering the floating point, this is about 1,100 times faster than the reference machine. So you can calculate the performance by looking, by using the benchmark programs. In the past, people found ways to cheat using benchmarks. So what some people did in order to make their machine come faster, they would develop special compilers, and they would optimize the compiler so that for the specific benchmarks, compiler would come out with very nicely optimized code specifically for the benchmarks, and that was a way of cheating. So now, of course, they have come up with rules that would prohibit cheating. Any questions or comments? Now let us assume that we want to design a new processor. Then how would you do it? So let's say you started working here with Intel, or maybe with AMD, and you're designing a new processor. Now you want to, now here of course we are focusing on performance. So one important step in design is simulation. So after you have come up with your design, you will simulate it to make sure it works correctly. And you want to simulate to estimate performance. Now, what factors control the execution time of a program? Now that would depend on number of instructions to be executed, what kind of instructions are we talking about here? Now these are obviously the machine instructions, right? We're not talking about high level language instructions. And remember, we are talking about the number of instructions that would need to be executed dynamically. So if you have a machine language program that goes from here to here and you count the number of machine instructions, that is not the number we are looking at. Because you may have a loop. So if you have a loop and if you go through the loop 100 times, then each of the instruction in the loop would need to be counted 100 times, right? So the number of instructions to be executed, and number of clock cycles needed for each instruction. Number of instructions to be executed, number of clock cycles needed, and then clock frequency. Okay, typically, how many clock cycles does it take to execute a single instruction? What did you think of one? Just a guess? Historically, it has taken multiple clock cycles for each instruction. So if you have an instruction, so let's say if you want to do, for example, a load from memory, so you have to allow maybe a couple of clock cycles to get things from memory, and maybe a clock cycle or so to get it into the register you want. And if you're doing an addition, then allow a few clock cycles. You need maybe a clock cycle just to get the instruction, and maybe a clock cycle or two to execute it. Later on, we are actually going to look at concrete examples when we will do the hardware. But in the past, it has taken typically multiple number of instructions. However, that was before they figured out how to do things in parallel. So first they figured out how to pipeline things. So now, instructions are not executed sequentially, but in any given time, a number of different instructions are under execution at the same time. And now they use multiple functional units. So you have this one, maybe this ALU, something is going on here, this floating point unit, something is going on here, and so on. And now, of course, they have gone even a step further. So you were looking for a multi-core. So if you have a multiple core, you actually have multiple processors there. And depending on what kind of process it is running. So if you have some type of process that you can parallelize, so multiple processors can work on it at the same time, and if it is supported by operating system and so on, then of course you do more things in parallel. So basically, these days you can do things in parallel. So by doing things in parallel, they were able to get things down to something like one instruction per cycle on average. Not in terms of beginning to end, that still takes multiple clock cycles, but every clock cycle they can finish a new instruction because of the parallelism. And in that case, we will say that the number of clock cycles needed for each instruction could be one. It could even be less if you have more parallelism. So it depends on, basically it depends on the architecture. So how much parallelism does the architecture support? Now here in this discussion, okay, let me mention about two things. When we talk about performance, we have to distinguish between two things. I kind of just referred to it. You have single instruction or single operation. Execution time as opposed to throughput. So as I was saying that these days they have a lot of parallelism and you have pipelining. So let's say if an instruction has to go through four or five stages, then maybe each stage takes one clock period. So maybe in a single instruction may still require four or five clock periods. But if you can pipeline those, then it is possible to arrange so that every clock period, a new instruction finishes execution. So the two things are, so this is from beginning to end of one specific instruction, or maybe for one specific operation. And here we are talking about the rate at which information is flowing. So which is a more appropriate measure? In most cases, it is the throughput we are interested in. Now if you are interested in the response time to a well-defined small operation, maybe you might be interested in this, how long it will take. But if you're interested in how long it takes for an average instruction to come out, then it is the throughput that we should be measuring, and generally it is the throughput that we consider. And now in our discussion, we are going to be considering
You will consider CPU and cache, and we will talk a little bit about memory, but basically we will focus on the CPU performance. We will not talk about operating system execution, which actually is important because you have the operating system is also running on it, and if you consider the whole thing, then time to time the operating system calls and operating system provides some functions. For example, we have seen that in MIPS, for input output operations, you do them through the operating system. So it is actually legitimate to consider operating system execution when you consider performance. However, to keep things simple, we are going to be focusing on the CPU time. And of course, if you are a, let's say, a laptop maker or a desktop maker, you need to consider both of them. But if you are a processor manufacturer, this is what you need to look at. So how fast your chip is. So let us, we will focus on this. So next time we will do some analysis, and we will see what are the trade-offs and what are the different factors that go into processor performance. And we will also talk about trends, Moore's law, and other interesting things. And so we'll continue next time. Did I collect your project progress report?
Excuse me, Professor. Can me and Amal send our progress report to the
Oh, by email?
By email.
Sure. Right? Yeah, okay, sure.
Okay.
Hi.
So, assuming that they can fit instructions and data into the cache that runs on the same CPU, couldn't it be possible for them to like accelerate reduce the number of instructions, the number of clock cycles per instructions? In a similar way as
Oh, I see. Yeah, by the